Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line we have the 2012 Yukon Quest champion. It is the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff. Hugh, how's it going?
Good morning, sir. Feeling a little rough this morning. There's been a lot of celebrating happening at a late night, hanging out with my buddy Lance, and it's still sort of sinking in, the whole feeling of what happened out there, but it was definitely an experience that I'll treasure forever.
You know, there's been hundreds of reports all over the place, everywhere from the smallest newspaper to even the Chicago Tribune. Today, I'd like to concentrate on some intricacies of the race and delve into some of the stories that a lot of people didn't ask you about on some of those big, the big platforms such as the Tribune, because this is your show and your fans are listening to it. So my first question to you is, how in the world did that 26-second feeling feel, you know, crossing that finish line with Moore so close behind you?
First of all, you know, in a way, people aren't going to understand this. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm just different. But, yeah, I feel for Alan in a way. You know, he's a buddy of mine, and not like we hang out or anything, but I respect the heck out of the guy. He's one of the class acts. He and his wife, Allie Zirkle, who won the Quest in 2000, have done a lot for the sport and continue to do so. They do a lot of studies with their dogs that actually help find cures for illnesses for humans. And so beyond the race, it was in a way weird for me because I was really going at it with Alan the last 5 miles where egging our teams on, you know, hooting and hollering and yipping them up. And it was pretty funny because, you know, Alan's from Arkansas and I played hoops in college. And I was born in Chattanooga, even though I grew up in Chicago, but I consider myself a little bit of a Southern boy. Anyhow, you got two, you know, Southern boys out here in the middle of the North just going at it with each other for probably 40 minutes. And we were just, I would be like, you know, egging the dogs on, going, all right, come on, let's go. And, he'd have, like, his little war whoop he was doing with his dogs. And every once in a while, it's about 4 a.m, I'd start laughing just because the whole scene was just something, you know, otherworldly. But coming down the river, basically, I spotted him with about 12 miles left in the finish. I had my light off. I was trying to be all stealth mode, you know. The dogs, they're on the scent of his dog team on the trail, so we're sneaking up on them. But then I realized, hey, you know, you got to be code of the North, you know, you got to respect your fellow competitors out there. So I actually turned my light on a good eighth of a mile from him just to let him know that I was coming, because, you know, he didn't realize I was started over 40 minutes behind him, so I'm sure he was a bit surprised that I could make up that type of time. But once I turned that light on, he bolted. So I think he might have switched the leader out because all of a sudden I couldn't stay with him. So then I put Juanita up in lead. I had Walter in lead for a lot of the race, but he's a little bit older, you know, so he doesn't have that fast pace. So when I got Juanita in the lead, that's when we started catching up to him. But then the speed of my team actually got one of my wheel dogs, a dog named Gringo that I got from John Baker. He couldn't keep the pace. He's a bit more of a husky, more of a steady trotter than a speed dog, which I'm typically running, Earhart, you know, sprintier dogs. So I had to take that dog, Gringo, put him in the sled because he was starting to tire out and slow the team down. And you would think that putting a 60-pound dog in your sled would slow you down, but we actually got faster because you can only go as fast as your slowest dog. So anyways, that's when I finally caught up to Alan. He was pulling like crazy. He had two ski poles. You know, he's on the back of his sled skiing. And finally, I got him to let me get by him. And we started going at it. Then I was being chased, and he was the predator. And that went for a couple miles, and we got right near the finish line. And all of a sudden, there was open water on the trail. And my leaders, Juanita and George, two of Annie's, army, they veered off the trail and up towards a parking lot, believe it or not. And right when that happened, I pretty much instantaneously almost just lost heart. You know, I was like, oh, God, it's never going to happen. Here we go again. UNF is falling apart. So when I went off the river into this parking lot, I didn't even, you know, Alan was maybe 100 feet behind me. And what happened was his leaders actually followed my leaders. And he looked at me and he's like, hey, where are you going? And I didn't really even say anything. I just ran up, grabbed my leaders, turned that team around, ran them through that water. And it wasn't like deep water or anything. It was just a few inches. But the dogs can get a little sketchy around, you know, open water. It was overflow. So I got the dogs across that little sheet of ice. And from then on, we just boogied on into town. And he was right on me. And that's the type of man he is and the type of competitor he is. And I was just, you know, determined. I was just determined to win this. And, you know, a lot of people were saying that UNF will never win a race. But if you look at the picture of me crossing the finish line, I'm a big believer that in spirits, and I really feel like the spirit of Geronimo was definitely a part of us winning, that's for sure.
That's awesome. You know, we talked about that a lot on this show about how you're going to run this race for Geronimo, and I know myself and all of your fans were rooting you guys on from wherever we were watching or listening. And congratulations, Hugh. I'm sure you're still reeling from all the hoopla and things will calm down here in just a little bit, and you'll be back to focusing on the next one. But my next question to you is, can you tell us a little bit about how you can make up 42 minutes on a trail in 100 miles or so? You know, we're not speed demons out there going 50 miles an hour. It takes up quite a bit of time to make up that amount of time. How did you do that?
Well, first of all, when I was, you know, staying out at Annie Lake and dating Tamara, I would go out to this little section of trail, which isn't that far away, and I do it as a training run out to visit my buddy Steve, who runs the restaurant out in Braeburn, which is where we left from. I was talking with John Earhart, who's Lester Earhart's son, and I used to work for their family up in Tanana, and I said that's actually my big advantage in long-distance mushing, I think, is that I used to work for sprint mushers, and so I have that mentality of knowing how to push them. And knowing how to kick and run and get it going. But also, you have to be steady. And so, basically, leaving Braeburn, I just knew I had to start making up time right off the bat. So, you ain't sitting around lollygagging. I got the ski pole out. And, Walter was a little hesitant to leave Braeburn, but once we got rolling, Walter, you know, my main leader, named after Walter Payton, he was possessed, I would say. I mean, it was unreal to see a dog 20 pounds bigger than any other dog in the team up in lead, just loping. I mean, going all out. And I actually had to go on the brake a little bit so he didn't fry out the rest of the dogs and go too fast in the beginning. But he kept this going for a long time. And then right when we got nearer to Whitehorse at the Dakini River, you drop out of the hills and that's where it's a little bit flatter. That's where I throw up some younger, faster, real, you know, genetically quicker dogs than Walter. They're like a guard like Derrick Rose compared to a bigger center like, you know, Shaq O'Neal or something, where that little guard's going to be a lot faster. But Walter got us through those hills, and Sebastian Chinella, a buddy of mine, a former champ of the Quest, I saw him about halfway out, and he gave me some German chocolate and let me know that I had already made up 20 minutes on Alan. And this is not – it's an amazing feat, obviously, but it's also doable, and it happens quite a bit in sprint mushing where the person who is the chaser actually has a bit of an advantage because the dogs have that predatory instinct to go and get them. And that's basically what I was doing with the dogs is I was just keeping it positive, keeping them, you know, happy, giving them lots of fish snacks every couple hours, as well as some red paw kibble. I give them a nice, good feed right before the last 20-mile run into town there. And I knew that that kibble in their stomachs would give them that energy at the end that they were going to need. It's just I never lost hope. And that's what you got to do in these races is even if you're not doing good on one run, and that's a major part of about the whole dichotomy of distance racing is you can have a bad run and the guy you're racing against might have a better run to get to a certain checkpoint like Alan did yesterday when, or 2 days ago when he came into Braeburn. He had but the run into Carmex before that, I had a better run than him. So we were just basically exchanging who had the better run. So I was just lucky enough that I was the person that had the better of the last run. Even though I was concerned a little bit about people saying that Alan, you know, might have choked or couldn't get the job done or whatever, but that's a bunch of, you know, BS to me. I mean, my dogs won this race is the way I look at it. And Alan did everything he could out there. And I, you know, that dude's won a bunch of races. And the funny part about it is even though Alan came in second place, he's still making more money than me because he won the first to Dawson. He gets the gold. So I think Alan had, for his second race, he had, you know, quite a good run. And I've done 12 of these, so I think I was due for one good run.
So let's talk for a minute about the infamous axe. You know, a lot of people have talked about that on Facebook and news reports all over the place. Can you first tell us about the mandatory gear? There's a set of mandatory gear that everybody has to take, and the axe is included. And when you leave that behind, obviously there's penalties. Can you tell us about the mandatory gear and then tell us about the axe itself?
You got the axe, snowshoes, all sorts of, you know, booties, a certain amount of dog food, cooker. I'm of the mind thought, having done this long enough, that I think there's a reason why there's a lot of people who probably don't really care for me and my big mouth, but I think that race organizations need to think about, you know, revising their rules on a yearly basis, and I often wonder why we're actually carrying some of this stuff. It's nice to pay homage to the past, but I barely use a sleeping bag. I never have even tried on the snowshoes, really, and most of mushers haven't. I'd say pretty much all of us. So that space that we use for this gear that is unnecessary, it'd be nice for them to allow us to use it to carry other stuff, perhaps more food or what have you. I don't think race organizations should be telling us how to act or what to wear. And unfortunately, it's almost like they're treating us like school kids, but that's just part of all these races. But the interesting thing is that you go to a race like the Cusco out in Bethel, and they're not like this at all. It's just, I think a lot of these races are so used to doing things a certain way that they don't really know how to be open-minded about how to evolve the sport. That being said, it is a rule. I received a fish with about 10 minutes before I was leaving Dawson from Shelley, who lives in Dawson. She's a friend of mine. I had asked her the night before if she had any extra fish. It showed up, but it showed up right before I was leaving. My buddy Jaime from Hawaii cut up the fish with the axe from the sled, and I was running around putting booties on, getting the dogs in harness, and by the time I was heading out the trail an hour or so from Dawson, I was looking in the sled bag going, oh my God, where's the axe? And unfortunately, the axe never made it back in the sled bag. And it was nothing on Jaime. He had, you know, he's from Hawaii. He didn't really realize, you know, what had happened until later on that day when my support crew put everything together and realized that I was missing the axe. So I got to the Scroggy Creek, the next spot along the trail where we see race officials, and I notified the race official there, who was actually Shelley, go figure, and she told me that I'd have to talk to Hans Adley about that. And Hans did what he had to do. I was surprised that he actually penalized me more. The time for my handler, Bruce, to go and get the sled was added to the 30-minute penalty, which I thought was sort of interesting, because what if I had a handler who was like a 90-year-old guy who could barely, you know, was moved slower. I got an extra 6 or 8 minutes added onto that 30 minutes, but I don't know. It was just one of those Huneff type of situations that I seem to find to get myself into. But if you think about it, man, you know, look who I'm sponsored by and look who the kids call me. I'm the Cat in the Hat. And the Cat in the Hat is always getting in trouble and trying to figure out how to get out of his huge messes. And that's basically what I pulled off.
Yeah, that's a great analogy there. And you do have a heck of a lot of support from those kids. And I was looking at the Facebook post just yesterday from all the teachers and how they were going to show the video to the kids and all that. What would you like to tell those guys, you know, your younger fans about a win like this? I know you said something very prominent at the end. It isn't necessarily about the win. It's about what you do in life. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, you know, my life hasn't been very easy as far as that a lot of tough things happened to me the last 5-10 years. And it's like an old girlfriend's mom once told me, you shouldn't love things, you should love life and love people. And that's just the way I look at things. And that old girlfriend's mom, she's actually related to Warren Buffett, so it's sort of funny to look at that way, look at life that way. And the way the economy is in this world, and life's tough for all of us. And if you're obsessed with money and impressing your neighbors, you're not going to see the true beauty and the true gold in this world. And that's just in finding out who you are and being real, spending your life trying to make yourself pretty in front of a mirror is never going to make yourself beautiful, that's for sure. And if you want to get out and find out who you are, I think you just got to get out and get some exercise and get a dog or whatever, get out in the woods and explore the world. I mean, it's you know, at the core of what I'm about, it's not about dog racing. It's about adventure and exploration of Alaska and the Yukon and getting out and being with the dogs and having fun. So if I could say anything to the kids nowadays, it'd be like people, you know, aren't always going to appreciate who you are or really understand who you are, but you have to find out who you are. And then once you realize what you would like to do in this world, get out there and take the risk and go for it. And it ain't going to be easy, man. I mean, I showed up in Alaska with $200. My name was sleeping underneath some bushes alongside the Tony Knowles Trail in Anchorage, but I just stayed true to my dream, and if you're willing to you know, put in some hard work over the years, I think life sort of karmically gives back to you in a way. But it's never easy for any of us. I don't care if you're, you know, Lance Mackey or Jeff King or any of the big boys or girls. You know, none of us have perfect wills. We're all humans, and so. You know, when things happen and go well, live it up, enjoy it, but be humble and realize how lucky you are that it happened. And believe me, I just feel pretty blessed right about now.
And you have every right to. Let's talk a little bit about the dogs. I know we've spend a lot of time focusing on the dogs on this show, and you've talked a little bit about Gringo and George and Juanita. How did the rest of the dogs perform over the 10 days, the entire course of the race? Did you have to drop many of them? And if you did, who did you drop? Because I know you listed all the dogs off on your startup show. So can you tell us a little bit about how the dogs performed themselves?
Yes, like I was telling Lance, we were sort of joking about it. Both of us were fairly unorganized for this race. I did pretty much most of my food drops by myself. I actually prefer to do it that way. I want to be a true dog man, and I don't want to have a bunch of people doing all my chores and everything for me. I want to be the one cutting up the meat and, you know, with getting the axe out and cutting up the fish and bagging the kibble. I want to know every, you know, piece of food that will be going through my dog systems. But that being said, a few of the dogs, I just got a few weeks before the race started from Tamara, and there are veterans like Juanita, and I only did a few runs with her. I did the Copper Basin with her. That's, you know, the qualifier race that we only did 150 miles of this year because of trail conditions, and she performed amazingly. Sicily is a dog I got from Ray Reddington. I had to drop her a little bit, maybe 500-600 miles into the race, and she's another dog that I just gotten recently back from Tamara. And the older dogs did okay, but they're getting lots of miles on them on a yearly basis. So they're, Lance and I were talking about how we're doing all these races actually might age the dogs quicker, because we're doing, you know, 3,000 miles of races a year. So they're more of the team players now than leaders, like a Tyler, Tolliver, Ellsworth. Those are all the Omen dogs. They're white. You'll see them predominantly in the middle of the team. Annie's Armies, you know, they're what it's about. They're all little 45-pounders with tons of energy and always perky. Alan had a lot of perky dogs in his team. And what perky means basically is the dogs have so much energy that when you stop, their whole bodies are twitching and shaking, and they're, like, rolling in the snow, and they're just full of it. They just want to rock and roll all the time. And that's the beauty of, like, Juanita. If we got here, Alan's team, or anywhere on the trail, really, you know, dogs can hallucinate from lack of sleep deprivation as well as humans. So every once in a while, Juanita would just start barking. And I think that energy just sort of carried on through the rest of her teammates. And if you ever look at a picture of Juanita, she's the spitting image of Geronimo. I mean, I was asking a lot of the veterinarians on the trail if you could have two dogs and a litter of dog puppies that were actually like genetically twins, and they said that they've seen it before, because I swear, like, Juanita is Geronimo in some respects. It's sort of just surreal to see her up there leading the way. But she was phenomenal, and she'll be up there. Jewel, of course, did well, but pushing the team as I did to catch up, I had to take her out of lead towards the end, and I stuck in her brother George, and he did phenomenal. And he's the amazing part of this whole race experience is not only was I able to pull this one off, but boy, we're looking good for the future right now. And I know, you know, Lance, Ken, Jeff, Martin, we all, you know, everybody looks forward to our Iditarod because there's so many beautiful dog teams. But on my wall in the house in Choke, there's a picture of only one dog team, and that's John Baker's dog team, because I know that is the dog team, and John's the man, you know. And if to go and be able to even have a chance of upsetting that team is going to be tough on any of us, because John Baker has quite the operation happening. But I'm looking forward to him. You know, Quest is amazing, and Iditarod is going to be a fun time as well.
So speaking of the Iditarod and the dogs that you have on the team now, are you planning on using very many of those guys in just a couple
of
weeks?
Them.
All of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. They're all ready to rock and roll. The beauty of this year is we actually have a few more days in between races. I mean, Iditarod doesn't start until the 4th, so we got weeks of time in between, which is awesome this year. That's why I used a lot of my main dogs. That's what people have to understand, and why if you're a gambling person, I'd be very careful about doing it with dog mushing, because you don't know what the mushers are racing with out there. Like, Lance had a fairly young team out there, which he did great with, coming in third. And so he had Rev and Maple and some of the older, experienced dogs that knew the trail, but he had a lot of two-year-olds on that team. And I never, and we've, you know, Lance is my brother in many respects, I never want to have a life like Lance's. In none of these sports, I feel sorry for the guy, because every time he doesn't win now, people want to know why he didn't win it. And in dog mushing terms, that's ridiculous. That just shows you a fan that doesn't understand the whole, all the variables that go into this sport. So even though Lance came in third, he did a great job. And I just had veterans with attitude. You know, I had an experienced team, and in dog mushing, that it's a big advantage.
So a lot of people have talked about the back-to-back and if that's possible. I know Lance has done it. I don't know if anybody else has done it. I don't know the history that close. But, you know, like last year, Dallas Seavey, he won the Quest and then went on to do rather well in the Iditarod. What are the plans in a couple of weeks? I know you don't like to talk about strategy, but is there anything you're thinking about now that you've got this under your belt and you're ready for the next one?
Well, I had the boys brought some of my Iditarod dogs to Annie Lake, so I'll be training out of Tamara's place here and running dogs there, getting Annie back in shape, and Nathan and some of the other older dogs that need a little bit more time. I'm hoping to make it to Minto to the native village just to the west and north of Fairbanks. They got a race called the Minto 90, which is the first race I ever did, and I promised those folks that I tried to make it out there this year for that race. And I'm not going to do it to race. I'm going to do it to give my respect to those people who, you know, taught me so much, the Riley family and Lloyd Charlie and that crowd. And I miss, you know, my Gunnas there, so I want to see my friends and just get the dogs in a little training run. It's 245-mile heat. It's a nice little warm-up. Just a week before Iditarod, and that's what a lot of Iditarodders do, is you do some good, solid runs, but a week ahead of time. And as far as racing Iditarod, you know, I don't race against, try not to race against people. I race against the trail, and that trail has had my number as much as the Quest has, more so, I'd say. The coast has always been tough on me. Lord knows what it did to my face a couple of years ago. But I think I'm learning through time, you know, and you can let tough times destroy you, or you can let them create a stronger hue, and that's basically what I'm trying to do. So I think we should do fairly well in Iditarod. I'm not predicting anything, though. I mean, anything can happen in that race. Mother Nature is always, you know, unpredictable, and... that was the weird thing with the Quest, man. It was warm and just weird. It's almost like you didn't want to be out there because it was too warm. But that being said, it could be 50 below in a week the way the weather is these days.
Let's talk a little bit about that weather. Last year, it dang near knocked out several teams of the Quest, and this year it was unseasonably hot for, you know, to be in the 30s and whatnot in that part of the country. Was that a concern for any teams? Did it help or hinder them in any way in terms of the Quest? Tell us a little bit about Mother Nature and how it helped or hurt you guys during the Quest.
I've done lots of mushing, you know, in the springtime races, and Kotzebue, they got the Kobuk 440, and I did around many years. It can be in the 20s and 30s. The Quest, we had mid-30s at times this year. And when it's like that, you're actually going to keep a bigger team together because you're not going as fast because the dogs can't handle going too fast. You're going at a more, you know, mellow, almost like being stuck in quicksand type pace because of the heat. But you're just snacking a lot more, give a lot of fish-based snacks, not big snacks, just consistently every hour and a half, 2 hours in there, you're just going to give a little something to keep them hydrated. And they're eating lots of snow along the way. They'll just be chowing on it, which is something we teach is, you know, I don't teach it, but we allow them to do is long distance to keep their bodies hydrated. But in sprint mushing, where they're only doing a 20-mile, you know, real fast race, those folks, they don't want their dogs chowing on snow because it's going to slow them down. But with us, we want the dogs to constantly, you know, have good hydration. That's what we're really worried about because their muscles can cramp up. That happened with Delilah, and that's why I had to drop her. A lot of the dogs is what I was dropping for. It's just because their bodies were getting a little cramped up from the warmth. But, yeah, it was definitely 10, 15 degrees above normal. And when you're going down the Yukon River, you know, outside of Dawson, and you're just, like, wearing a baseball cap and a hoodie, it makes you wonder about what's happening with the world. But it's sometimes it's cyclical, and who knows? I know the groundhog said we're going to have 6 more weeks this year, and maybe we're just having a little Indian summer, but we're having it in the winter, and winter will come back with a vengeance, which is quite possible.
So let's talk about winning the race. On your report there at the finish line, you said you've never won a race in your life. Does that include all of the mid distances and sprint races as well, or were you just talking about the big boys?
No, that's everything, man. I've won certain, like I was first Anvik and I did a ride, and I've got the first Dawson Award in the Quest and stuff like that, but I've never actually won a race. So, you would think I'd be, like, overly ecstatic and going crazy and all that, but realistically, I've done so much mushing that for me, it's, you know, how I'm all about the journey and enjoying life as well. And I was just on such a mission for Geronimo that that's really what this is all about, was just, you know, honoring his spirit. And he was definitely out there, that's for sure.
So to win the race, you received a $28,000 or so payout. And a lot of people think, wow, that's a heck of a payout. But let's put that a little bit of perspective if we can. That's pretty much what it costs to run a race like this, including food and that sort of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about the expense of mushing in regards to the winnings that people win in these big races?
Yeah, you're pretty much just collecting a few more than breaking even, but you're not really. We're not out here for the prize money, which sadly enough has actually gone down over the years. I really think for mushers to get this sport elevated to a higher degree, we're going to have to become more involved in promoting it, all of us, as well as more involved in the race organizations, getting more involved on committees. And this, it makes sense, you know, because a lot of the folks that have been helping out with these races over the years are not necessarily folks that are out there running dogs that much. And they might have back in the past, but a lot of these folks are more bureaucratic folks that are, you know, just want to be a part of the scene or want to support, you know, whatever race they're involved with. And I think as much as if we want to see bigger purses or if we want to, you know, spread the wealth amongst the crowd more and have more mushers get prize money, we've got to be more like Joe Reddington. We got to get out there. And with the internet, you saw the Quest was getting a lot of help there at the end through Facebook. I think as mushers, instead of all of us trying to promote ourselves, which, hey, man, nobody does it as much as I do probably, but we need to promote our races, and we need to band together, and we need to I just think these races should be a lot bigger. I think we should be making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's just not because I need the money. I ain't about money, that's for sure. But I think compared to these football players and these basketball players, those guys don't do squat compared to what we do. And none of them could even do one of these races. And I bet you I could take Michael Jordan. I bet you I could beat him in a game of horse. I used to play hoops, and I'm pretty darn good at it. So I think athletically speaking, there ain't too many people that are as talented as some of us mushers are. I don't want to be all cocky or anything, but I think realistically that what we do out there in just over a week makes, you know, these other sports athletes look like a bunch of indoor, you know, city folk. And what we're doing out in the woods is magical, is the way I look at it.
Well, you know, you had a heck of a challenge there to Michael Jordan, so we'll see if he takes you up on that. I know he doesn't like to even sit next to people on the airplane, so we'll see how that comes about, Hugh. So let's talk a little bit about just to hone in a little bit on the winnings or the money of it. A lot of people call themselves professional mushers, and they do this, you know, to earn a living. How do people earn a living this way if a majority or just a little, you know, a couple of dollars above is going back to the expenses? How do folks earn a living as professional mushers then if the purses are so small?
It's like anything in life, you have to diversify. You know, I sell my kennel merchandise, the hoodies and shirts and hats, and I do my school talks in May, and I do another school tour in the fall period. And you got to be cheap, man. Like when I got here to town, I only had a few bucks to my name, and I didn't have any decent pants. All I had were my bibs from the race, and I was sweating like crazy. So I went over to Salvation Army and bought a pair of jeans. I don't really shop at malls. I'm not really a clothes hound. I don't really need a bunch of wear like that. I've got a lot of, you know, T-shirts and stuff from schools that I've talked at that I'll wear stuff like that, but I'm not going out shopping a lot. For me, it's more for the dogs. But, yeah, you got to be fairly cheap. You got to, you know, be good at making your dog food, not overdoing it as far as feeding goes. A lot of people will come and help, and they'll realize that when you feed dogs too much, that's not good for them. And all these people at their houses on the lower 48 that have these big, way oversized dogs on couches and try to make their dogs happy by giving them food, they're actually hurting their animals. And believe me, I talk to a lot of veterinarians who come up for Iditarod and Quest and volunteer to take care of dogs. And it's pretty sad, the state of dog care in America, and how as obese as young kids are becoming, it's even worse with animals. And that's just because people don't realize that food does not make you happy. It's good; it can be good for you, but you have to exercise. And if there's anything that maybe people down south learn from this show, is get out there and get some exercise, not only for your sake, but for your dog's sake. And for me, that's the beauty of what I do. I'm not into being rich. I worked, you know, as a golf caddy, man. I worked for some of the richest people in the world at Westmoreland Country Club. And one thing I learned from them is that money don't make you happy. And some of the happiest people at that country club were actually the Mexican workers that were working on the grounds and taking care of the greens and the fairways and stuff. And life is an attitude, and if you want to be happy, you're going to be happy. And if you're not going to want to be happy, then I don't want to be around you, to tell you the truth.
So hold on just a second. I got to go back to this for just a second. You said that you just won the quest and you went to the Salvation Army to get a pair of slacks.
Yeah, yeah. That's me,
that's awesome. You know, I think that sums up the Gypsy Musher 180 degrees right there. That's something that everybody should really pay attention to, is just how humble that a person can be. They just won one of the most major races in mushing, and they still head over to the Salvation Army to get a pair of slacks. I love that, Hugh. That's awesome. So let's talk.
I'm just stuck in my ways, I guess, as far as shopping goes.
That's okay.
My dad, you know.
Let's talk about, we have about 8 minutes left. I want to do two more questions to you, Hugh, before we go. The first one is about your amazing handler support. I know Bruce was doing his best to update the folks on Facebook with his blogs and things, as well as your Hawaiian buddy that we spoke to a few minutes when you were in Fairbanks. How did they do during the race? Did they perform to their expectations?
Well, in the beginning, there was a little bit of turmoil going there. They're, you know, two different personalities, and one's got a fiery Latino type of temperament, and the other's a mellow, you know, Washington fella with a bunch of daughters and more of a teacher-like figure. But, you know, they started to get really happy once I started doing well. And they did great in Dawson and were very organized with stuff for, you know, we had to take care of the dogs and take care of putting ointments on their bodies and feet and massaging them. And a lot of this race is how you take care of those dogs in that layover in Dawson City. It's a big part of this race, and you have to have a nice support crew. Allie Zirkel, next to John Baker's crew, Allie's the most professional musher out there, I'd say, or maybe Jeff and Martin. But Allie had a real nice setup with her brother-in-law, Ray, and her crowd always does great. But, yeah, without your support crew during the quest, you know, they're driving around every checkpoint, and they have to – they're exhausted as much as you are. They're doing a lot of sleep deprivation, too, driving all the way from Circle to Dawson City. That's quite a hike. And they pulled it off, though, and now we're enjoying the fruits of our labor.
So my last question, and then, of course, you can say whatever you like in regards to what's coming up next, but right before you started the quest, we're going to just venture over to the Iditarod just a little bit, kind of a segue here. Right before the quest started, they changed up the trail of the Iditarod and removed one of the most notorious parts. What's that?
Are you trying to get me in trouble with the Iditarod head guys?
No, not at all, because a lot of people have commented on this, and I just wanted to get your take on it, on them removing the section of the trail known as the steps. What do you think about that, and how does that affect kind of the history of the Iditarod and what's to come for a race like that?
I think a lot of this is a knee-jerk reaction to all the wipeouts on the video last year, and obviously, you know, Rick Swenson breaking his collarbone and all that. Honestly, man, compared to the Quest, the steps are nothing. Quest has a lot of hairier sections of trail. That's just because it's not used as much. And I think I did it for numerous reasons. You know, they got a new mine going through that area, so it makes it a safer trail, less expensive to have to put in the trail. Money's tight even for a big race like the Iditarod. They're nickel and diamond everything. My buddy Ray Reddington, Lance, a lot of us, you know, feel sorry for these newer folks that haven't done the race before because they're definitely missing out on a part of history. But I also give it up to the Iditarod for making the trail safer for the dogs. And that's what these races should be about. And it shouldn't be about how tough you are or, well, that's what they did back in the day. It should be about putting in a trail every year that gets better and safer for the animals. It's also going to be weird, though, because you can't ever again compare winning race times. You can't say, like, if we break the record this year, that it's the same trail as what John broke the record with last year. It's just a different trail, so they're going to have to start the record books all over again. It's going to be different. We all knew that this, for me, the thing about mushing is I hear, if you are another musher or another person, you say something about me, I'm going to hear it. And I don't even want to hear it, but people in the mushing community, everything travels. And so I knew about the story midsummer. I'd say I started hearing rumors about it from different folks. And considering the Iditarod allows a lot of rental teams, I'll call them. You get an Iditarod anywhere from 6 to 20 teams every year that are basically people renting a dog team to do the Iditarod. And it's going to be safer for those folks that perhaps don't have as much experience, and I'm sure that's part of why maybe the Iditarod had numerous reasons why they're making this change. There are, on a yearly basis, a lot older mushers in the Iditarod, which would, you know, perhaps make it easier on them too. But it's still 1,000 miles, and an Iditarod, Mother Nature is definitely the determining factor, and the coast is always going to be hairy. You're always going to have the blowholes coming down from Top Cock Hills. And from what I'm hearing on trail reports from different folks around the state, around Alaska, is that there's lots of snow this year. So it's probably going to be a mush fest. And mush fest usually advantage Team Baker, I'd say, because John's got the nice, steady, you know, solid beasts of nature that he does that are be able to plow through that snow. And that's the type of dog that you need in a race like this where you're wallowing through a few feet of, you know, mushy snow. That's why lower 48ers or people not from this area don't realize that warm weather is much tougher than cold weather. And we prefer it to be around 0, 10, 20 below zero. When it gets to be 20 above zero, that's when the trail just gets pretty pathetic, and that's when it's not as much fun out there.
So, Hugh, we have just a couple of minutes left. You have 2 weeks and a day or so until Iditarod Madness starts with the banquet and all that. You mentioned going to a race up in Minto. Anything else? How are you going to enjoy this? Or are you just going to kind of put it away here in a day or two and move on to the next one?
Oh, yeah. I was talking before I even came into the finish line about how, you know, it's time to run dogs once we get back to Whitehorse and get ready for the next race and take care of myself too, take a sauna, maybe go hit the hot springs. Obviously, I've been having a lot of celebrating going on, and that's been a lot of fun. I think it behooves us as mushers, and we learned this especially from Lance, is when life is good, you don't go and high out and, you know, sit on the computer. You get out there and be amongst the people, and you share your accomplishment with them. And it's a way for us to not only let them be a part of what's going on, but we give them an opportunity to see something special that doesn't happen all the time. So I'm going to be out there. I'm doing some talks in Anchorage before the race, and I usually do a few school talks before I get around. And I miss my buddy Ray Reddington's one of my best friends in the world, and I always like to hang out with Ray and his wife Julia down there. I stay with my buddy Dave Shears. You know Dave. Dave set you up with your place, so Dave's one of the cooler old school mushers that I really dig hanging out with. And it's gonna be a fun year, man. I'm looking forward to having Jeff King back. People say what they want about Jeff, but you know, I call him Mr. Wizard for a reason. He's a neat dude, and I've learned a lot about dogs from him over the years. And, you know, there's a lot of fun going on with Iditarod. It's always I tell people that the Iditarod is a zoo and the Quest is a circus. And the Iditarod is definitely a zoo because there's people coming from all over the world for it. And it'll be fun. It's our way to honor, you know, Alaska. And for me, Alaska is my heaven. And so I'm looking forward to getting out there again.
that sums it up pretty good. We'll have a show before the Iditarod for sure. We do have 2 weeks before then. We'll make sure that we have a show on before then. Hugh, anything, any parting words you want to mention before we close?
Just thanks to everybody out there. I could definitely feel the good love out there. Even before I won the race, I could feel that people wanted me to do well, and I was just glad that we could pull off this miracle. And it's one that I have a feeling people are going to be talking about for a long time to come.
Well, there you go. That is the Gypsy Musher Yukon Quest champion now, Hugh Neff. Take care of yourself. I'll see you pretty soon. When you come down to Anchorage, we'll definitely get together and see what we're going to do for the next version of the Gypsy Musher. So take care, Hugh. Give my best to Bruce and everybody else that helped out, and I appreciate all the updates and things that they did as well, okay?
All right, good.
All right.
Let's go.
So, there we go. So that's Hugh Neff. Make sure you visit his website, gypsymusher.com. He does have some awesome gear there you can pick up as well. So on behalf of our host and myself, this is Robert Forto and the Gypsy Musher on Blog Talk Radio. Talk to you soon. Goodbye.